Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
In 2006, he published a book, Profession Ethicien. He was a member of the working group on the role of the religion at school that produced a report in 1999, known under the name of Rapport Prou. And he was also a member of the Comité Conseil of the Bouchard-Taylor Commission.
Well, thank you very much to the hearty souls who are staying around Saturday afternoon. You get to the point at a conference where you have to worry about, this has already been said, but not by me. So I'll try to make sure that I get through. I could just spend the next 25 minutes convincing Arthur that if you have the choice between a hockey game and a string quartet, it's a tough call. But I won't do that. So. Let me start with an anecdote, which really started me thinking about journalism ethics. As Xavier just mentioned, I spent a year as a member of the advisory council of a body that was tasked by the government to look into the issue of a combination of religious diversity in Quebec. Now, largely due to, I'm going to simplify things a lot for people who aren't here. I'll go quickly for people who have, this is old news for people who live here, largely because of a number of sensationalistic news stories that appeared in one media outlet in particular. A sense began out of nowhere that we had gone too far, that somehow Quebec society was going too far in accommodating religious diversity, which was largely a buzzword for Islam, but to some degree, Jews came in for some bashing as well. You can ask me, Arthur, about the famous tainted window scandal at the YMCA, but I don't think I have time to recount that story. That could be your first question. Now, Charles Taylor and one of the most eminent historians and sociologists in Quebec, Gérard Bouchard, accepted to head up this commission, which was given a multi-million-dollar budget to write a report on the issue of reasonable accommodation. And it spent a year crisscrossing the province and brought in some eggheads like me to advise them. And they produced a report which came out about exactly a year ago, which was quite circumspect and careful. And I think, though I have problems with some of the detail in it, I think it's quite a really excellent launching-off point for a potential debate in the society on the way in which we should think about our own version of the kind of laïque secular society we want to be, et cetera, et cetera. Now, 5 days before the report was handed down, a journalist from the Montreal Gazette and a journalist from the Journal de Montréal, which was the newspaper that had basically fomented all of this to begin with, leaked an early version of a chapter of the report and spun it in a way which was relatively sort of sensationalistic. For those of you who, just to remind you, a chapter was leaked, I won't tell you which chapters, and though none of the recommendations were explicitly sort of referred to in headlines, one of the things which the authors perhaps unadvisedly said en passant, that Quebecers should be more adept at languages and in particular they should speak English better, was made into a sort of full banner headline across the Gazette and the Journal de Montréal. The result of this, so it was a reporting of the partial truth. In other words, they didn't make up the chapter. The chapter actually existed, and they got their hands on it. I know how it got there, and I can tell people if they're interested. It was still a working paper, and the report was coming out 5 days later. The news conference had been scheduled, and the report actually physically existed. I had it in my hands when the report came out. So what happened is that people essentially, this story in the paper short-circuited the debate, because all of a sudden people started making up their minds about what was in the report on the basis of this sort of tendentious reporting of an early draft of one chapter, right? By the time Taylor and Bouchard sat down 5 days later to say what was in the report, there had been so much debating and arguing about, you know, what was in it, that people had made up their minds pretty much on either side. French, speakers were quite, their feathers were quite ruffled by the suggestion that any problems in Quebec society were entirely attributable to the fact that Quebecers weren't tolerant enough and didn't speak enough English. And there was very little, it was an uphill struggle, and I think an uphill struggle which ultimately failed, to get the report itself, back onto the front burner. And essentially, the report, I think, has died as a piece of potential sort of focus for public policy debate. Bless you. Now, when this happened, people who know me know that I don't get angry very easily. I was furious to the point where when the journalist from Journal de Montréal called me to get my sort of, you know, quote, to get some quotes for me, I very sort of foolishly yelled at her in a taxi going downtown. I was absolutely furious and livid with her, convinced intuitively that some fairly elementary rules of journalistic ethics had been breached, and that, to the extent that journalism is supposed to be the servant of democracy, journalism here undercut democracy. It prevented the debate from happening, and arguably it even began the crisis, the false crisis, on the basis of which the report which came out. So, I was quite livid. But then when I started reflecting on, what had happened in a cool hour, and also talking to some of my journalism friends, I started finding it more and more difficult to say exactly what they had done wrong. And so this presentation is kind of an attempt at finding out what they had done wrong, or indeed, and I want this to be quite clearly distinguished from the first way of spelling it out, what had gone wrong that had allowed this to occur. So this is a thumbnail version of the facts, probably partial in its the way that I've recounted it. If Jeff Henrich and his colleague at Journal de Montréal, whose name escapes me, were here, they'd probably tell the story slightly differently. But I think it's probably unproblematic to say that the impact of the story on public deliberation was deleterious, at least to the extent that people didn't feel as moved as they might otherwise have been to read the actual report and listen to what Taylor and Bouchard had to say. How many more people would have read the report had the report not been leaked? I have no idea. The number is probably not 6 million, right? So what went wrong? My first intuition when I screamed at this Journal de Montréal reporter was to think that there had been some kind of clear norm of ethical journalism that they had breached. But when I spoke to my friends, who are people who I regard quite highly in the sort of journalism business, and said, what did you think of what Heinrich and this other person whose name I forget did? And they said, well, Daniel, we would have done the same thing, right? If the thing had landed in our lap, and I said, well, look, it was coming out 5 days later. It's not like Watergate, where, had it not been for the fact that the stuff was published in the Washington Post, there is information that wouldn't have gotten out. At least we can think that it wouldn't have gotten out. 5 days later, people would have gotten the whole story. What gain is there? Well, the gain is they sold the papers, right? So absolutely, universally, across the board, every single reporter, friend, or acquaintance that I spoke to said, yeah, we would have run with it. Where the difference was with the tendentiousness of the report. But it wasn't so much they did something immoral by not representing it in a balanced way. There's 90 pages in the chapter that they leaked. There's a lot of stuff in there. You have to pick a hook. You have to pick an angle. So there's going to be, we would have picked a different hook. We would have picked a different angle. The most that people were willing to say was that the fact that the English stuff, Quebecers should speak more English wasn't explicitly mentioned as a recommendation of the report, well, that should have been clearly mentioned, and there might have been some slight breach. But, you know, it's not exactly the sort of thing that, you know, would justify someone like me foaming at the mouth when this first occurred. And it occurred to me that there's something like something in the newspaper business, which we've heard about at various points, referred to both positively, negatively, and neutrally, which is sort of the role ethics of journalists, which I call the categorical imperative of the scoop, right? If you can beat your competitor, whether your competitor within the same paper or your competitor in another news outlet, to a story, then to sit on it in the because of some sort of greater public interest that you think might be served, for example, just by waiting 5 days to see what Taylor and Bouchard have to say for themselves, is itself a kind of a breach of an internal morality of the journalistic practice. And this was something that was absolutely clear to me. This isn't something like a pressure that people felt from outside. Would that we lived in an environment that didn't require of us that we tried to scoop our competition. It would be a wonderful world. The norm was fully internalized. You know, if I get a scoop, I'm going with it. These things only happen a few times in a journalist's career. So, and, you know, there was a complaint made to the press council, and they were exonerated. There wasn't much controversy about whether they had done something that required even a very, light slap on the wrists. So they clearly hadn't breached any existing norms of journalistic ethics. So the second thing, the most superficial kind of analysis or diagnosis of what went wrong seems to me to fail. We can ask ourselves a second question, which is, can we think of a better professional ethics, a professional ethics that, were it in place, would be better for us all and would have, had it been in place, justified the kind of foaming at the mouth that I evinced in my discussions with this woman. And you can think about things like a greater emphasis on accuracy and balance. You know, that journalists, perhaps as part of this code of ethics, should be required to be more balanced in their reporting. We heard about the requirement of balance come out in various ways in these last 2 days. Now, you know, here's the thing about accuracy and balance. Well, accuracy, you know, journalists, as far as I know, we have had stories about journalists who literally made stuff up, but I take it it's a fairly rare occurrence, right? They make phone calls, and they know that their rear ends are out on the line if they are caught out just making something up, making up a quote or making up a fact because they couldn't find one that served their purpose. So accuracy seems to me a bit of a red herring. The real sort of meat of the story is around this idea of balance. Now, you know, thinking about it very self-critically, I realize that, you know, balance is, could it be that what balance is, when I read a paper and I think, that was a balanced report, is that reporter shared my biases, right? And the way, and when I react to a story by saying, oh, that was completely biased, well, you know, you had a journalist who wasn't sharing my biases. Biases are essential to being able to report, it seems to me, because you have very, very complex facts which have to be accounted for in a very short space. Lisa told us this morning about the move towards capsule. Even fairly capacious New York Times articles on Sunday have a word limit, right? And that is going to mean that even one chapter in the Taylor Bouchard report, a decision, an interpretive decision is going to have to get made about the hook, the angle, right, with which to sift through the information that's there to present something that is comestible in an article form. So, you know, you can still think of balance as something like a regulative ideal, as a kind of aspirational goal. Journalists should aim to be balanced. But as part of a code of ethics, something that you can actually sanction journalists about, you'd have to be able to make sort of a rule. This is what a proof of absence of balance is, and that seems to me to be just very difficult, given the fact that the employment of bias seems necessary to, and here I use the word bias in a completely descriptive way, to the production of the kind of, you know, they're not writing books after all, they're writing articles. So it's hard to turn the requirement of balance into something like a followable rule that people can then be sanctioned on the basis of. Now, and here's a more sort of substantive reason to be worried about a professional ethics that bore down too hard on the individual ethics of individual journalists. You know, I'm reminded of the first slide in Arthur's presentation this morning about people as they are and institutions as they are, given people as they are, something like that. You know, I think it's always a good idea to economize on virtue, to use the Madisonian phrase, and minimize the extent to which we expect good results to come purely from sort of the control of individual behavior. And here it seems to me we have a reason to worry about it as well. Actually, we probably don't want journalists to be too cautious. We don't want journalists to have a code of ethics looming over them so heavily that they'll think, well, this is a good story to run with, but maybe, you know, I'll be accused of having been unbalanced or something like that. You know, one way of putting it is to say it could be, and this is an empirical claim or an empirical question, hypothesis, rather than a philosophical one, that the price of a Woodward and Bernstein is the occasional Jeff Heinrich, right? You have to have people who feel, as it were, free to muck around, put stuff on the front page, not always as cautiously as, you know, us eggheads do it when we publish our academic articles. Very often what will happen is things will go awry, as, again, I think they did in the reporting of the Taylor-Bouchard Commission. But from time to time, you will get a nugget of democracy-saving truth, like Woodward Bernstein, and the one justifies the other. And then you have to get into a balancing thing, right? Are we getting enough, as it were, Woodward and Bernstein-ish bang for our whatever? But, you know, I worry that an ethics of individual journalistic responsibility that tried to push too hard would end up depriving us of some of the goods that we think journalists are still capable of providing us with. So I conclude somewhat tentatively and regretfully that despite my having sort of had a very visceral reaction to the reporting that was done, that Heinrich and his colleague did nothing wrong, nor should codes of professional ethics be revised in a way that would, if applied counterfactually to them, make it the case that they turned out to be wrong. So she's not here, but I apologize to that woman who I screamed at on the phone. So if we still think that something went wrong, and I still do think that something went wrong, we can sort of stop where I ended up the first part of this analysis, and given the time, people might wish that I did, but I won't, and say, look, you know, it's an imperfect business. We try to make balance it out as best we can. It'll just be the case that if we want the Woodwards and Bernsteins, we're going to have to tolerate the Heinrichs. So the question is, can we fiddle with the system in such a way that we'll at least minimize the extent to which we will get the bad outcomes without losing too much of the, or any of the positive. And by working on the system, as it were, within which individual newspaper or other journalists work, rather than working on their individual ethics. Now, here it seems to me that, again, and here we still have this idea of balance. What we're aiming for is balance in presentation. What we want is for the reading and listening and TV watching public to end up without, you know, having to spend 6 hours a day doing it, getting a sort of fair representation of the issues upon which they will eventually be required to vote in elections, a fair representation of the issues that they ought to at some point feel sufficiently moved about to call up their MPs and complain about, a fair representation about the issues about which they might want to organize and mobilize in their communities or what have you. How can we achieve that? So it seems to me that there are two roads that we can take, which I'll call, for lack of better terms, pluralistic and monistic. The pluralistic thing is to say, look, we're not going to eliminate the biases. The only way in which to achieve systemically the effect that I've just described is to have a lot of different biases out there, right? And so that people can have access to, you know, the right-wing bias, the left-wing bias, the centrist bias, the sovereignist bias, the federalist bias, and out of, and here, you know, we sort of have the Millian idea, the John Stuart Millian idea of out of the competition between these ideas, somehow truth will out. Now, that is a view that I feel some degree of sympathy with, but it's nonetheless the case that I think some reservations have to be made and some limitations of the model have to be pointed out. So, you know, eggheads who, like me, who work in the area of moral and political philosophy know about this problem to do with pluralism, right? So, you know, there's a justification of kind of reasonable accommodation for religious and other kinds of communities that runs like this. Well, you know, there's no one truth. There are a lot of different ways of organizing the good. And, you know, we should give different kinds of communities, even if they're a liberal, a lot of slack, because if we don't, we're not being pluralistic. Now, it's an irony that's been pointed out by a number of people, including myself, that often what pluralism will end up giving rise to is a lot of non-pluralistic little islands, right? A lot of locations in society where people are institutionally and psychologically made less likely than they would otherwise be to access the plural values that there are. So it's a kind of a sort of a paradoxical result if we start from the premise of pluralism and end up with a lot of islands of monism. And here, you know, something, why am I talking about this? Well, it seems to me that something analogous is a potential danger, really, in the area of, of the media, which is that, you know, just to put it very briefly, there are a lot of different ideological viewpoints out there, but it's not necessarily the case that people have world enough and time to actually engage in a sufficient survey of them to actually get the benefit of the million benefit of the combination of a lot of views. At the end of the day, I don't know how many people there are, like my wife and myself, who are still slavishly addicted to our newspapers and get four every day, right, on top of the other publications that we get. You know, most people receive one newspaper on their doorstep, and that is the view. Even if that newspaper coexists in an environment with a lot of ideological, other ideological viewpoints, it's not necessarily the case that that person will get the benefit of it. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we translate the pluralism of views that are out there into actual pluralism in the way in which people encounter the news? And that's not an obvious, there's no obvious answer to this. The other point which I'd make about this pluralistic approach, and this is something that came out of the presentations, a couple of the presentations, and especially the roundtable yesterday, So ideological pressures may lead to a multiplication of points of view, right? So we have people on the right, we have people on the left, we have people in the center, we have sovereignists and federalists in this country. And were it the case that only ideology, right, were determinative of what was in the newspapers, then we'd get a lot of pluralism. But market pressures may lead to convergence, right? So the point was made yesterday that, you know, if you're the only paper that doesn't cover Barack Obama's poodle, or what is it, a Portuguese water dog, well, you know, you may think, you know, with all the energy in your editorial heart, that this is not the most important story of the day when 20,000 kids have died in some distant African country of an easily controllable disease. But do you want to be the only paper on the newsstand, right, that doesn't have a picture of, what's the dog's name? Bo. Probably don't. I mean, Le Devoir often gets, like, forget it. I mean, it's often the case that Le Devoir is the one paper in the world, as far as I can tell, that resists these pressures, right? And there's something, and you said something about it being on another planet, right? But the fact is, you know, not many newspapers can survive with le tirage qu'a Le Devoir, and anyway. You published Beau on the front page? Okay, well, you're getting more like a Le Devoir. Okay. So if pluralism, if the pluralistic approach isn't going to work, let's not worry about bias. Let's be happy and just let a thousand flowers bloom. Well, there's the other approach, which is also one that we've engaged in to some degree. And, you know, treat information as a public good in almost the technical sense of the term, and see that there is the responsibility on the part of the state to make sure that that good is provided where the market can't be relied upon to provide it efficiently or at all. And so, you know, subsidize, as we would subsidize, you know, high-end culture because we know that it's of worth, but we don't think the market will sustain it, subsidize quality press. Now, you know, there are problems with this as well, which I think we're all aware of, and here I really get into the it's all been said but not by me territory, which is that it's not as if a supposedly independent press, made independent by the fact that it is immune from private pressures, is going to be immune from all pressures. You know, human, all too human politicians who fund newspapers are probably not less prone to the temptation of wanting bang for their buck than are people who own them in the private sector. And so it's not clear to me at any rate. I mean, you know, I hate the Harper conservatives just as much as the next guy, maybe even a little bit more. But on the other hand, you know, when they were out in Calgary before they achieved power, foaming at the mouth at the liberal media from Toronto and Quebec. They had a point, right? I mean, the perspective that you get from sort of listening to the CBC news is, it doesn't come from nowhere, right? It's not a Martian point of view that has been made completely independent of all pressures. And so, you know, this is being filmed. There is no justification of the hateful measures, the hateful, spiteful measures that were taken by the Harper government in cutting jobs, the cutting budget from the CBC. But you can imagine yourself with the ideological point of view that Harper and his cronies had in Calgary, watching the CBC for year upon year upon year upon year, and feeling like when you got to Ottawa, showing those bloody Central Canadian Liberals is something that, you know, we would have liked Harper to have been a bigger man than to have given in to his sort of revanchist kind of inclinations. We can sort of understand that he had them. So, you know, we can think of various kinds of ways in which to try to immunize public broadcasters from political whim, but realize that this is going to be something that will be a constant struggle. And I end, so I really end now with, so basically what I said is, you know, there's this thing called balance, which we have a sort of vague sense of what it might be, but it's pretty vague. And we, I worry about requirements that would make individual reporters and journalists responsible for the balance of the media. So then I looked at institutional solutions, and, you know, there's no perfect road to balance, either through the multiplication of sources in the private sector, or through the public sector, or through the coexistence of the two. And then there's just a philosophical problem, which I want to end with balance to begin with. Any presentation of the facts, as I said a minute ago, and, you know, not just of opinion, of the facts, right? It's not just that opinions that appear on the op-ed page and the editorial page are obviously biased by the editorial writer's ideological point of view. It's also that the way in which you present the facts is tinged by your ideological point of view. What is, and this is not a rhetorical question, if anybody has an answer, please tell me, what is a commercially digestible, balanced way of presenting the economic crisis that we're facing today? Does anybody have an answer to that? I don't, right? I'll just stop there. So I end up in a much more confused point than the one that I began with, but I'd be very happy for any questions or comments coming from out there that might help me find my way to more clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. That was really a lot of fun. So I'm wondering whether you're a, there's the million view, and then we can call it the super million view. And I'm wondering which of these two views you hold. So the million view is that it's a good thing that there's all this diversity and plurality, even though we know for sure that some people are going to get it wrong, because you don't know up ex ante, which is the right view, and in the marketplace of ideas, right? So that's Mill's view. But Mill's view doesn't underwrite me from the first personal point of view a justification for putting out stuff that I know to be false because it's good for the rest of you. So there's this asymmetry here on the Mill view, which is that each of us should still try to get it right, but we predict that some of us can get it wrong, and that's a good thing, which certainly shouldn't be suppressed and probably could be encouraged and subsidized. That's Mill. Then there's Super Mill, right? Super Mill is, ooh, wow, because there are all these great social goods, when some of us get it wrong, I'm going to get it wrong. You know, I'm going to throw out complete nonsense, knowing that, who knows, you know, maybe if, when people engage with me. So of course, it's not going to work for falsehood, but it could work for recklessness, right? So it's on the Woodward Bernstein idea. So it's a good thing that some journalists, maybe most journalists, are reckless. That doesn't yet underwrite the super million view that I ought to intend to be reckless, because after all, it's a good thing that some of us are reckless. So do you hold the million or the super million view? It actually depends on, it doesn't matter for regulation. Regulation is the same way, but it actually affects what the first personal reasons are for a journalist.
Right. So, you know, this goes back to something which, I'd actually be very curious to hear from the practicing journalists that are left in the room. You know, this thing that in various forms and in various ways and with different degrees of emphases has been reported to me by every single reporter that I've spoken to in the last year about this issue, which is what I call the categorical imperative of the scoop, right? So the categorical imperative of the scoop, which, you know, nothing that I said gives us any reason to be kind of opposed to that, and yet maybe there. So is there any way, I'm thinking out loud here, of incentivizing a different kind of behavior within the newspapers? You know, we're talking about whether there's anything that can incentivize Woodward and Bernstein or Filipino nanny kind of reporting once the newspaper goes by the wayside and we no longer have the sort of status struggle of figuring out who's going to be page one and who's going to be page B14. You know, and there could be Drudge, you know, the way in which, you know, Google hits and whatever, you know, we can imagine that. Is there any way of incentivizing kind of, you know, I'm known never to give a presentation without at least one hockey analogy, and I forgot to make one, so I'm going to make my hockey analogy now. Hockey has you know, all sorts of prizes at the end of the year, and one of them is called the Bill Masterton Award. Now, the Bill Masterton Award is given each year to the most gentlemanly player in the league, as judged by his peers, right? So gentlemanliness is not, you know, it's not necessarily going to win you more Stanley Cups. It's not necessarily going to make you a better scorer. But we recognize that it's a good thing that there are still, you know, players who, you know, who, as it were, abstain from a kind of behavior which they know that if they were to engage in it more, they might actually be more successful than they are, right? And so every year, it's kind of a weird thing, right? Usually these are people who don't score a lot of goals, you know, who probably during the year their coach said, you know, can you go into the corner and, you know, hit a few more times? But yet we realize that it's not, the sport would be poorer were these often dysfunctional fellows, you know, to be completely erased from the game. So, you know, I'm just thinking out loud. Is there any way, can we imagine a Bill Masterton Award for, you know, people who didn't come up with scoops? You know, I win the award because though I had the chapter in my hand, I realized that the public good would be better served by, you know, holding off, given the fact that the press conference is 5 days away and we're going to know what's in the report from A to Z that day. I don't know. But right now, that incentive looms so large that I don't see the counterweight. Lady Bing, what did I say? I'm sorry, yeah, Lady Bing. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. I got my hockey analogy wrong. It's late in the afternoon. It's late in the afternoon. What? 2:45. Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Daniel. So that's, yeah, I have a question about... In fact, about trust, I was reading a paper this week called, in fact, one of my colleagues was reading a paper, but you know, you don't have to read an academic paper to talk about that. But no, I'm kidding, but I read this paper a couple of years ago, and this is a paper called Building Trust in Divided Societies.
Yeah, I heard of that paper.
Yeah, that's one of yours. So. So, and it was a paper on the importance of trying to, instead of building or instead of promoting something like, you know, a very specific or some very specific conceptions of the good life, about the importance of building trust in divided societies. And that's funny because I was thinking about that when we were... a lot of people were complaining about the way that the media organizations in Quebec were acting during the Commission Bouchard-Taylor. And I had the feeling that one of the main assumptions behind our critical diagnosis was that they were not failing to... act in a balanced way. They were failing to promote trust in a divided society. So I would like to know what you think about that. Do media organizations have a responsibility to promote trust or to try to achieve trust in a divided society?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's always a very worrying thing when someone begins a question by citing your own work, because you're going to be... Now, in this particular case, I think it's the answer is overdetermined by the following fact. I mean, one of the best things in the report, I think, is the 15 or so cases that were, you know, the top 15 that led to the crisis were identified. The narrative that was given in the newspapers was given, and then the facts, as this, you know, were presented, and most often it was, I mean, verging on in one case the. The infamous "no pork in the pork and beans" episode, verging on just journalistic fraud. So I think that in this case, now let me give you an analogy. I worked for 4 years as some of you might know, as the director of the Quebec Public Health Ethics Commission. And one of the issues that is often faced is that, you know, public health problems are not tolerant and multicultural. In other words, sometimes they particular communities are targeted in ways which, you know, were the, you know, genetic problems, viruses, even patterns of behavior more multicultural and tolerant, they would have distributed themselves more nicely across the population, and in this case they don't. I mean, this was particularly acute, not in anything that I had to work on, but when public authorities in Ontario had to decide on how to disseminate information about SARS, right? Now, there is no question about where SARS sort of came from, and there is no question of the fact that, you know, it was probably the case that the Chinese community was, because of its patterns of migration, and more at risk than other people, outside of people who were directly in hospital establishments. Now, if you just say that, right, it's going to lead to a lot of problems. It's going to lead to, arguably it'll lead to a lot of problems anyway. But one of the things that is sort of public health communications 101 is to say, when you have a public health problem that is not behaving multiculturally or tolerantly, bring in people from the community and come up with a strategy for not masking the information. You never want to mask the information, but a communication strategy that brings them on side. So I think you can have, in this case, your cake and eat it. In other words, you can, as it were, if there is information that you think is newsworthy, and here I continue, you know, to wonder whether, the fact that yeshiva boys needed to have a frosted window so they could continue praying is something that is really, you know, front page newsworthy. But, you know, if you think that it's a newsworthy issue, if you think it's an issue of public concern, you know, bring in members, you know, have a sort of participatory process where the information can be brought out whilst trying to minimize the stigmatizing impacts that it might have. So indirectly, yes, I think they do have a responsibility in not eroding trust more than needs to be eroded. I don't think you should ever withhold a story because you think that it might, but I think you may want to think about the way in which it'll be diffusé. That's it.
Yeah. One thing I would like to say is journalists sit on stories a lot more than people sort of realize, right? We sit on, I mean, one story we've been sitting on for a long time, which I believe we finally published this weekend, is the new imam at the main mosque in Ottawa is there's a faction trying to run him out of town, right? And we've sat on that for a long time, not reported, even though we get phone calls. So there is that, there is the categorical imperative of the scoop, yet at the same time, there is the fact that we do try and do, or due diligence. But you did raise at some point in the discussion the possibility, is there an ethics code that could have sort of governed this? You know, you're right, it was 5 days, it was going to come out. Is there any sort of like Frank Selke of journalism, like should they have, or not Frank Selke, Lady Bing, right? Should they have maybe just sat on it and something like this? I think that kind of ethics code, you could probably could come up with one, right? But I wonder, sort of throwing this out to the philosophers, the working philosophers here, is that not another term for an information cartel? If you see what I'm getting at, right? Which is the idea that, here's the example, right? The Melissa Fung disappearance. She was a Canadian reporter who was kidnapped in Afghanistan a year ago. The media sat on that for months. We agreed at the highest levels to sit on that story. And when it finally emerged, like I knew for months before most of my friends did, by what right did we sit on that story? I mean, we sat on it for very self-interested reasons, right? But there's sort of a you know, we talk about Mill a lot in free speech and the positive consequence, but there's also Tom Scanlon's view, right? Which is, or Tim Scanlon's view, right? I forget which one is it now. Tim, right? Sorry, that it's the right to hear something that underwrites the free speech guarantees. And you know, who are we to hide this sort of stuff from the public? You know, given that we know something. So that's
right. No, it's you know, and my the conclusion. If the conclusion that you took away from it was that I thought that it was wrong, all things considered, after considering the issue in the cool light of day, I'm inclined now to say that it was not wrong. It wasn't wrong, certainly given prevailing standards within the profession. And that doesn't mean that the profession's standards are so low that anything goes. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I've sat in a room of journalists who have, over beers, told me about all the sexual scandals that have not emerged in the Quebec media. Because there's just a kind of an unwritten code that unless it has to do with children, I can't remember what, unless it has to do with children or somebody so pompous in their moral self, you know, whatever, that you know, you just don't talk about that stuff. So it's not clear to me that, you know, it's not the case that the my conclusion isn't the professional ethics standards are so low that you know. So, I mean, In this particular case, so there's the partial information that you get from leaking Chapter 8 in its, whatever, 3 months before version, and then there's the information that is going to come out 5 days later when the full report is published. Now, and there is, as a journalist, you're not naive, you've been around the block a few times, you know that if you run with the first, it's going to undercut the second to a significant degree. Now, in this particular case, contrary to Melissa Fung, I think, contrary to other things, the end result of the publication seems to me to be less rather than more, well, less rather than more, a public that is less informed rather than more informed. And this touches on an issue, and I'll just hand wave at it because I didn't have time to get into it, though it's something that I'm very interested in. You know, we somehow this sort of came out a little bit in the discussion of Ian's paper. You know, we kind of have this Pollyannaish view that more information will lead to a more informed public, but that's a very, very problematic view, right? I mean, the step between information and informed is different. But put that aside. In this particular case, it does seem to me that if what we want is more information, then it could be that sitting on the story will paradoxically give rise to more information in this particular case. But I do agree that in a lot of cases that you mentioned, there is, you know, there is a privilege being asserted on the part of journalists who pretend not to, who you know. Well, I'll stop there. I'm blathering on.
About the scoop culture, I was asking myself when you were talking about, this Bouchard Taylor Commission and the fact that two journalists run the story, and I was asking myself what would I have done. And I think, like your friends answered, I would have gone with this story.
I would have been shocked if you'd said anything different.
I think I would have done it a different way, but anyway. And maybe I don't have the answer to your question, but about this, this run for the scoop and this quest for the scoop, but maybe two elements of answer. Well, first, as long as we have, well, it's a very pragmatic view because I live with it every day, the scoop pressure. And as long as we have a dynamic of competition in between the media, especially in a small world, especially in well, I talk about Montreal, that we have three francophone papers and one anglophone. It's really, really hard to get rid of that pressure because I feel really uncomfortable when I know that if all the papers have a story the day after and I don't have it, I feel bad. So this is one thing. So I think this. Logic, this dynamic of competition in between the media corporation is one thing, is really important. And also another interesting thing that we are fed by people that and by actors that have personal interest. And there's a media plan strategy. And just to give you an example, last week I was writing, it was a kind of, well, scoop in the first page about, it was not really a scoop, man. Well, about the ambulance, the fact that they gave me a sheet of with information, with statistic I was not supposed to have. And, well, and it was it said that they told me that the ambulance was because they were out of people of ambulance, they couldn't to an emergency, they couldn't get there on time. And so I ran the thing, but the guy told me that, and really put emphasis on the fact that I was the only one. And he called me in to say, well, will you publish it tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, because I can't keep it for a long time. So we're dealing the exclusivity. And there's another media that I won't point out now any, I won't give any names, but there was a couple of papers at the moment that are really putting pressure on the fact that it's exclusive. And I think that, well, we're not, as journalists, we're not hostages, we're not victims, but I think that the only way of get rid of that unhealthy scoop disease, let's say, is to live on a planet, or, I don't know, or to be really, really virtuous.
Yeah. Well, there are a few things that I want to say. The first is that, again, you know, I'm not saying that the scoop, you know, it could be that the energy that comes from the scoop culture, the categorical imperative of the scoop, is what gets us, you know, the kinds of stories that the result will be that you'll have a lot of energetic, overexcited, you know, slightly reckless reporters who from time to time will, but you can't have, you know, it could be that you can't have one without the other, right? It could be that you can't have one without the other. What I was wondering aloud about is whether there is or could be other kinds of incentives built into the system that would make it the case that that some reporters will you know that there will that there could be some kind of counterweight, right, that will allow us to have you know the cake and eat it, as it were. It could be that there can't, right? It could be that the scoop, given the kinds of pressures that you mentioned, is such a strong force that no countervailing, you know, no Lady Bing, and even in hockey, you know, winning the Lady Bing trophy, let's face it, is you know, no big deal when you know, you have the Art Ross and the Maurice Richard trophies that are the real prize. Let me say one thing that I haven't said. You know, the one thing that hasn't really come out yet, and I just want to put it out there because it does seem to me to be a part of the big puzzle about media ethics, about journalism ethics, that I've been wondering about, is it's not like, so there's a naive view that we could have, which is that there's stories out there, right? And then it's a race to the story. Right, and so whoever gets it first. So there's a kind of a story realism, let's call it. That's mine. I've labeled it. Anybody who uses it now has to quote me. It's a scoop. So what happens very often is that the media may, you know, there will be a kind of an effect which is entirely endogenous to the press system itself. We'll create the story right out of whole cloth, not necessarily. And then there's a kind of it could probably be modeled in game theoretic ways. The other outlets have an option. We didn't think of this as a story before they came out and made it a story, but now that they've made it a story and people seem to have responded to it as a story, what do we do? Do we go to what we think of as the most important story independently of what they did, or do we allow ourselves to be caught in the kind of vortex that they've created? So, you know, so what happened with Heinrich? He got the story. I think it came out on, let's say, Friday, and then on the Saturday, everybody was reporting about Heinrich, right, and his colleague, right. So they became the story. Now, in ways which I can't quite put my finger on, I find that problematic when reporters become the story, right? There's something there that it's too late in the afternoon for me to be articulate about, but. But you know, I still have an adverse reaction to. So you know, sometimes scoops are just that, are just wholly made up. They're not responding to anything out there in the real world that needs responding to. And, you know, anyway, I'll just stop there because I don't have anything intelligent left to say.